Seven Afghans and one U.S. soldier are dead after a suicide car bomb attack in eastern Afghanistan today. An 11-year-old boy was among those killed. That's according to Afghan police, though wire services report some higher casualty figures. The bomber attacked a U.S. military convoy. The Taliban says it is not responsible but blames a splinter group. Pakistani police say that gunmen have kidnapped an Iranian diplomat and killed his driver. The attack happened in the northwestern city of Peshawar. It's near the Afghan border, close to tribal areas now controlled by Taliban militants. And Vice President Dick Cheney and his wife Lynn are to receive Vice President-elect Joe Biden and his wife Jill tonight in Washington. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org.
Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider, with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about Cuba and about relations between Cuba and the United States. Our guest for the program is Luis Perez. He's an historian who specializes in writing about Latin America, particularly about Cuba. He's a director of the Institute for the Study of the Americas at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he's professor of history. He's authored a number of books, and among them his most recent. The title is Cuba in the American Imagination, Metaphor and the Imperial Ethos. It's published by the UNC Press. In which he takes a look at some of the images, the variety of images that have been used over time here in the United States to describe Cuba and this relationship between the two countries. He notes that Cuba has been described as a woman, as a neighbor, and perhaps most frequently as a child. All of these, he argues, are calculated to transform the self-interest of America into a kind of a moral duty. We'll be talking about how these images serve the foreign policy interests of the United States, and also try to talk a little bit about perceptions as people look the other way, perceptions in Cuba of the United States, and see also if we can bring it up to the present and talk a little bit about where things stand now and the possibility for some change in relations between Cuba and the United States. I do also want to mention that our guest will be giving a talk on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4 o'clock, The Cultural Politics of Identity in the Cuban Revolution. That's the title. This is an event in the MillerCom series, and these are always free and open to the public. So anyone who is interested can hear what he has to say. He'll be speaking at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. Otherwise, here on this program, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
One of the things that you write about in the book, and perhaps it might be a place to start, is the long, long interest that the United States has had in Cuba. Now, certainly the United States for a long time has believed that Latin America and the Caribbean were its sphere of influence. But I think you would have to say that perhaps more than any other single place, the place that has consumed America and American interest is Cuba. Why?
Well, within that sphere of influence, there's a kind of geopolitical reality. And one needs only to take a look at a map of the United States in the early 19th century and understand how American political leaders and policymakers would understand the future of the United States by looking at the situation of Cuba, with the acquisition of Florida and the acquisition of Louisiana. Cuba emerges and is transformed into the American southern frontier. And once that realization dawns on American political leaders, Cuba becomes a fixed obsession of Americans that this piece of territory, this island, has to be part of the American national system as a means to protect its strategic frontiers, the traffic that's flowing out of the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico and which passes through that little sliver of 90 miles of water toward and from Europe. Hmm.
So it's really at heart, this is – it's about geographical proximity. Is there more, though, to it than that?
It starts with geographical proximity. It starts as an abiding concern that somehow this island in the hands of a weak Spain could be transferred to a foreign power, and a foreign power situating itself on the island of Cuba could threaten U.S. interests, both strategic, economic, commercial. And, of course, one of the ironies is that Jefferson's nightmare turns out to be Kennedy's reality with the placement of missiles in Cuba in October 1962.
Yeah. So certainly as far as the United States was concerned, many people in the country was concerned, this was a matter of security, strategic realities and so forth. What is, I think, very interesting, and this is really the main focus of the book Cuba and the American Imagination, is it focuses particularly on the Spanish-American War. What Americans told themselves about what was going on, what their interest in Cuba was, why they should get involved, and why they should want to essentially acquire Cuba. These sorts of strategic concerns, security issues, that really wasn't discussed. Not at least in the popular discussion. It was something else. Entirely.
What I feel like I've done in this book is to sort of eavesdrop in American conversations during the 19th century, how Americans are speaking to one another. The degree to which Americans have summoned images, metaphors, euphemisms to explain a purpose that is really embedded in a strategic interest but are never acknowledged as part of a public conversation, public discourse. And so that the war, as the United States edges toward war, strategic interests are transmitted by way of beneficent purpose, beneficial intent. Mm-hmm. This is not a war to advance U.S. interests or for territorial aggrandizement. It's a war designed to aid the suffering Cubans, and therefore the Americans feel good about themselves as they undertake this selfless task.
Yeah. And I don't know if this is going too far, but I could not help as I was looking at the book and looking at some of the things that were written about Cuba and about the United States and about the Spanish-American War at this time, how much the things that were said to me echoed the kinds of things that were said about the United States and why we should be involved in Iraq.
It's a conventional wisdom that historians take the present back into the past with them. And there's no – I could fully acknowledge that this book was in large measure inspired by Iraq. To listen to the conversations, to listen to the debate, to listen to the justification for war. Increasingly, it's a war that within 60 days no longer becomes a matter of American interest. Is a war to assist the long-suffering Iraqi people from to deliver them from dictatorship, to deliver democracy. And I'm fascinated by the degree to which that those representations seem to resonate. I've had interesting conversations with classes where I would ask the students, would you support a war in Iraq if it was for the purposes to seize and secure indefinite and in control of Iraqi oil for the national interest? And the overwhelming majority of students say no. However, you ask them, would you support the war in Iraq to bring democracy to the Iraqi people, to bring liberty and freedom to the Iraqi people? The overwhelming majority of students say yes. So there's a coding by which national interests are transmitted into a larger public discourse that we seem to, with alacrity, buy into. Mm.
Well, and also it seems to me, and I wonder if this is, if at this time, I'm going back now to the other time, to 1898, the Spanish-American War, whether in fact that the idea that the United States, by virtue of its power, there is a moral duty. It is incumbent on the United States to use that power to promote freedom, democracy, liberate people around the world. That was what people said about Cuba and the Cuban-American War. It seems to me, or perhaps the question is that where that kind of idea in America really starts?
I would argue yes. This is the first overseas venture by the United States. And I'm struck by the degree to which the language, these representations, so fully inform the debate for war. And the discussion of the war with Spain in 1898 in American history textbooks are loaded with the proposition that this was a war for humanity. This was a war for the rescue of the Cuban people. This was a war to assist the Cuban people achieve their independence. In other words, this is a war that Americans celebrate as one of selfless intention and selflessness. It's a good war because the U.S. went to war for a good purpose to aid a suffering people. And those representations seem to embed themselves in American foreign policy, and it's carried through World War I and every war thereafter. The decision to go to war so often is itself embedded and encoded in these euphemisms, in these metaphors, that we only go to war for the benefit of other people, not for our own interest. Mm.
And I think you also make the argument that perhaps it was, in a way, unfortunate for the United States that it turned out that this was so easy.
So easy.
The cost of the United States were very low, and suddenly here the United States, literally these first elements of empire just fell into our lap. It was almost as easy as that, and which no doubt led people to think it would always be easy.
If you are on the side of good and justice and the right cause, it's a very tempting paradigm to set up. And what I argue in the book is that the Cubans received no credit for 3.5 years of having a withering effect on the Spanish, and just when the United States enters into the Cuban War, it's a 6-week, 8-week war. But the Cubans had been fighting for 3.5 years and had seriously debilitated the capacity of Spanish to respond to the U.S. invasion of Cuba.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with Luis Perez. He's professor of history at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and has written a lot about the history of Latin America, Cuba in particular. And the book that we're talking here a little bit about is Cuba in the American Imagination, and it's out fairly recently. It's published by University of North Carolina Press. He's here visiting. We'll be talking about Cuba and Cuban-American relations this afternoon in a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. So, again, anybody who is interested can attend. It's 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. And here on the program, questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to have you talk a little bit about this business of images. And there are a lot of very interesting things, all of them. I think really they're all editorial cartoons, but most of them editorial cartoons, talking about this, depicting this relationship and the ways in which Cuba seemed always depicted as someone that – as an individual embodied either by a woman or a child, somebody who was threatened, somebody who was in need of protection, somebody who literally needed to be taken by the hand and walked down the road towards modernization and advancement and civilization and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, I think the first image that I deal with, because it is a pervasive image, and that is the proposition of Cuba's neighbor. The more I thought about this word, this concept, the more I realized that it has really expanded into the entire Western Hemisphere and has particular relevance. And we speak of Franklin Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, and we speak of neighbors that occupy our front yard or our backyard or our back front doorstep. And so these are all images that are designed to conjure up a sense of a spatial relationship, a proximity. And yet, when one thinks of a neighbor, what is embedded in that concept is also really a normative system. That is, a neighbor is somebody you care for. A neighbor is someone who you look after. A neighbor, there are kind of reciprocities with a neighbor. A neighbor, in other words, the spatial is transferred into a moral system. And given the inequality of size and power, And having the United States a neighbor is not necessarily a blessing. So that having to proclaim Cuba as a neighbor and then seeing Cubans in rebellion and suffering means that the United States has a moral duty as a quote-unquote neighbor to assist the Cuban suffering. And so that's one of the first metaphors that enters into the political conversation in the 19th century. And then it goes through a series of successive metaphors. Cuba is portrayed as a ripe fruit, and the ripe fruit is somehow going to fall, and there's the notion of political gravitation. Just like the apple has no choice but to fall to earth because of gravity, Cuba someday will fall from the control of Spain and gravitate north. Cuba is represented as a geographical construction from the sediment of the Mississippi River, and therefore, because it is North American territory, it properly belongs to the United States. And then, so all these images come into existence, come together in 1898, when Cuba then is portrayed, there's a kind of anthropomorphic transformation of Cuba where Cuba becomes a woman. And the woman, obviously, is the damsel in distress. And men need not be told what their duty is. Okay, that's all red-blooded Americans know what they've got to do. Once the damsel in distress is rescued, then the transformation is almost overnight. Cuba is rendered as a child, as an infant. And that provides the logic with which American control over Cuba is established, because clearly one cannot allow a child to have access to power and the status of self-government. There has to be a training, an education, a rearing. And at some point in the indeterminate future, this child will grow into adulthood, which never happened, and then be ready for self-government, but only after proper education, proper training.
Yeah. One more thing, and I have a couple of people I want to get to. I guess one of the things that's so striking to me, and it goes back to the point we were talking about a little bit earlier about parallels in the kind of language between the way people talked about this and the way people talked about Iraq, is that at the time, a lot of these images, the sort of metaphor for the child growing up and learning to be an adult and organize a society and so forth, the image that you saw a lot was the image of a child learning to ride a bicycle.
Yes.
And Uncle Sam was the parental figure.
Yes.
And the Cuba was the child on the bike. And what was so striking about that, and unless people think we're torturing the metaphor too much when we talk about Iraq, is that a number of people in talking about Iraq used the very same image.
Exactly.
Of the child and the bicycle. People talked about one of these days we're going to have to take off the training wheels. We're going to have to take our hand off the seat. A number of notable people in the Bush administration used that very same metaphor.
It's the endurance of a colonial metaphor that spans 100 years. That's exactly right.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll get to the first right now, and that is Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I think I didn't Google it, and I probably should have, but the ripe fruit metaphor, I'm understanding, is it was Jefferson's dream. You mentioned Jefferson's nightmare of some more potent opponent being in Cuba than Spain or something like that. But, would you confirm that he's one of the first people that was thinking it in those terms, or that the ripe fruit was the goes back to Jefferson?
It's actually the author of the idea of the ripe fruit and political gravitation is Adams.
Oh.
But Jefferson also used this metaphor. It becomes a standard metaphor. Sometimes it's a fruit, an apple. Typically it's a fruit. It's an apple. Sometimes it's a pear. It goes through various types of fruit. But the idea is that it hangs from a tree, and at some point it must fall because the law of gravity is inexorable.
Yeah, and we're there to catch it. So.
Exactly. Right. And every now and then through the 1830s and 40s, because the fruit did not fall, we see people going to the tree and shaking it to see if they could hasten the fall of the fruit.
I just wanted to emphasize some other part of the Spanish-American War that I find is part of American exceptionalism, and that's this idea of odious debt. The U.S. helped Cuba renege on all of these debts that their colonizer, Spain, had foisted on them. And, you know, this was their dictator, their comprador regime. that incur these debts. But the U.S. is one of the big opponents of anything like that in the contemporary realm. You know, Saddam Hussein, as you're talking about,
right,
Iraq a bit,
right,
was our dictator for quite a while. We extended loan guarantees for grain purchases, which he then freed up money to spend on dual use, et cetera, et cetera. But we won't, you know, I guess some of that debt was forgiven, but the U.S. is incredibly recalcitrant to put the shoe on the other foot, as it were. So I think that's an important dimension of the image of American as the exceptional power and only trying to help people ride their bike down the road. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to comment on that?
I think the issue of odious debt is still an inadequately explored theme in 1898. It's begging for deeper examination and analysis for the implications it has in the 21st century. Yes.
Let's talk with someone here in Effingham next, line 4. Hello.
I want to ask a specific question. Understanding a great deal of what is being discussed, I would, if your guest can, give us an overview. I mean, to acknowledge these things, to write books about them, and the practice of it and all that, and we need to know where we're going. And the capitalist colonialism now has humanity by the throat, and there doesn't seem to me to be any real overview of the result or the consequences of that, and how soon the economic downturn is, I think, a symptom. But the where are we going, and what is going to happen to humanity on this planet by these practices that are being discussed?
If I could reduce humanity to the case of Cuba, I would. My own understanding of the relations between Cuba and the United States is that Cuba is paying dearly, a dear price for its effort to achieve national sovereignty and self-determination, to the degree to which that the U.S. policy has had from its inception a punitive dimension to it. Cuba's transgression seems to have been that it has aspired to and made good on the quest and the pursuit of independence in what was historically a client state of the United States. And as a result, there is a dimension of an unforgiving facet of American policy toward Cuba that's 50 years old. And I was struck the other day thinking about the election of Obama, that U.S. policy is now older than the next president of the United States. And it's half the Republic of Cuba, half of its history has been under American sanctions. And I think it's an indication of the degree to which the ferocity of U.S. policy just not to relinquish or acquiesce to the loss of client states.
We are at our midpoint here. I have one more caller we'll get to in just a moment. A couple of callers we'll get to. I would just, for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I would like to introduce once again our guest, Luis Perez. He's professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is in the Millercom series, The Cultural Politics of Identity and the Cultural Revolution, the Cuban Revolution. That's this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus of the U of I. It's free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend, certainly welcome. You might also want to look at some of his books, including that book that we've been talking about here. His most recent, it's titled Cuba in the American Imagination, Metaphor in the Imperial Ethos, and it's published by the University of North Carolina Press. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next we'll talk with somebody in Danville on a cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. How much influence did the abundance of Cuban iron ore, say the Mayari Range in particular, which supplied Bethlehem Steel with a good deal of its ore at that time, have on U.S. foreign policy directed toward Cuba in the Spanish-American War?
The principal drive for the war in Spain, there are several sectors of political influence, of investments in Cuba. Certainly, iron ore mines of eastern Cuba is one. The sugar estates of Enema corporations, particularly Edward Atkins, who had the ear of the McKinley administration, and prominent senators who were in the Foreign Relations Committee, bankers, utilities, railroads, all had had influence and access to influence in the days and weeks leading up to the war. Just as important were the Cuban planter class itself, that faced with the prospects of the loss of Spanish patronage and protection from what it perceived to be unstable social elements, increasingly through direct means and indirect means, communicated with the McKinley administration, pleading for U.S. intervention to rescue what were representatives of the Cuban planter class, many of whom, in fact, had taken out U.S. citizenship. So we have a kind of quote-unquote Cuban-American population who were the property-owning classes who were appealing to the United States to intervene in the island for the preservation of a kind of social system that was under siege.
Is the caller still there? Did you want to follow up?
Well. That's fine. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call. Let's go on to someone else back here where we are in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
On that ripe fruit metaphor, was there any parallels? I mean, there's always been the question of what happens to Cuba after Castro, and I suppose now after the other Castro, the brother. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, was there any parallel between the fall of the Soviet Union and the decline of Spain in terms of what the protector or something gone what would happen with Cuba or not?
The Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union was uniformly perceived, certainly in the United States, to be the final domino to collapse in the entire socialist bloc. And certainly the conventional wisdom was that the Castro government could not survive the loss of Soviet patronage. And to hasten that, the United States government passed the Torricelli Law, which applied more sanctions to Cuba. And then that was followed in 1996 with the Helms-Burton Law, which applied still more sanctions to Cuba. And the expectation was that Cuba just simply could not survive. And in fact, if one begins to look at from 1959 to the 1990s, predictions of the end of the Castro government are basic or a staple of the American discussion on Cuba. The ripe fruit metaphor was not used, but it was widely presumed that Cuba would, that the Cuban government would collapse and the Castro system in the 1990s.
Because the fact that Cuba was much closer to, I mean, they said the same thing about North Korea, but of course North Korea is, you know, much more geographically distant from the United States than Cuba, which is ever since the Grenada invasion, with the backyard metaphor has gotten
right, right.
into it.
Yeah, the backyard metaphor is again one of these staples. It was used by Lyndon Johnson in the invasion of Dominican Republic. It was used by the Reagan administration in the Contra operations in Nicaragua, where, again, this was a backyard. It was used by Reagan again in Grenada. So this is a metaphor that has, like the nine lives of a cat. It has multiple use and recurring application.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about, the images that Americans were presented with to describe Cuba, the damsel in distress, and then, of course, the idea was, well, of course, any red-blooded American male knew what, you know, you were supposed to do. You were supposed to rescue the damsel in distress. And then there was the transformation from the woman to the child. And you talked about the fact that at one time, at least, the idea was that someday Cuba would grow up and that somehow, as far as the United States was concerned, never did happen. And so in the 50s, we still have this very paternal kind of senior-junior parent-child relation going. When the revolution came, what really were Americans and American policymakers thinking? And did they in fact think that this was something that they could control?
What I found fascinating in the first year of the Cuban Revolution, 1959, looking at the classified records of the State Department and the personal papers of the Eisenhower administration, secretaries of state, and various functionaries in policymaking capacities, is an astonishing bewilderment and inability to make sense of what was going on in Cuba. Because on one level, there was the obvious development in Cuba that this was a government that was really challenging American hegemony on the island in ways that had never been done before in Latin America. Certainly not a government challenging the United States with whom the United States had diplomatic relations. And on the other hand, the inability for American political leaders and policymakers to accept that it was really happening. In other words, what I see happening is this kind of cognitive dissonance that they see it happening, but they can't believe it's happening. And there's a kind of paralysis of American policy because no one knows how to make sense of this. And what I develop in the book is the argument that that Cuban events overtook the efficacy of existing metaphors. There was no metaphor to describe what was going on in Cuba. The first metaphor that they applied to the new Cuban government turned out to be Cuba's child. And when Fidel Castro comes to visit the United States and Cuban delegations come to visit the United States in March, April, May, and June of 1959, we now have the declassified records of the internal memorandum of the National Security Council and the State Department and the White House. And stunningly, there is a discussion of Cubans as children, that they had to be treated as children because if they weren't treated as children, shown a stern hand, shown firmness, then like all kids, they would go off and do crazy thing. And in point of fact, I think it's in 1959, an editorial cartoon in the book from a South Carolina newspaper that shows Fidel Castro in a playpen, and the caption of the cartoon is "Spare the rod, spoil the child," suggesting the United States had to be firm. So here is a metaphor that just really persists. And there's a famous meeting between Vice President Richard Nixon and Fidel Castro in the spring of 59, in which Richard Nixon took great delight subsequently in his memoir saying that he had spoken to Fidel Castro as a Dutch uncle, firmly as a father figure. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that we also have from Fidel Castro's advisors Castro's reaction to that meeting. So we have the two sides of that meeting. And the two or three people with whom Fidel Castro spoke after he left his meeting with Nixon all confirm how enraged and indignant Castro came out of that meeting. He said he tells one aide that he just spent an hour with this guy who just continued to scold him. And the last thing that the new Cuban leadership had come to Washington for was to be scolded.
Yeah. That's perhaps you could talk a little bit more. We'll turn this around because we've been talking a lot about the way that the United States looked at Cuba and images that were employed, images and metaphors to describe Cuba and this relationship. Let's turn it around and talk a little bit more about how this looked from the Cuban perspective.
The Cuban perspective toward the United States is very complicated. It's a love-hate relationship. There is a long memory in Cuba of being the object of American policy. And at a political level, the relations and the memories of those relations are bitter indeed. On the other hand, the affection for American culture, American cultural practices, the degree to which Cubans are fans of American Hollywood movies, baseball. There's a complexity of this relationship that operates on two different levels, and to this day, American culture in Cuba still resonates, even though politics is non-existent. But the American culture still is very, very popular in Cuba.
What now, you know, given the fact that, right up to, the present, the position of the government largely has been this position that says, as far as Cuba is concerned, we have to be tough, we have to be aggressive. It's not seen as a peer relationship. It's always been seen as an unequal relationship, and that we're not going to deal with Cuba on equal terms. What now? There is the opportunity for a different kind of relationship. At least we're going to have a change of, administration. Do you think that it is possible now that the United States and Cuba could move towards having more normal relations?
That's the expectation. Emails that I've received from friends and colleagues in Cuba suggest that euphoria in Cuba over the election of Obama was no less than it was in Illinois. And there is a clear expectation among many quarters in Cuba that Obama, in his both during the primary election season and during the general election, who indicated his willingness to speak with Cubans, portends a change of relations. This is the first time that a presidential candidate has actually indicated a willingness to speak to the Cubans in the last 50 years. So that's promising. Obama has also indicated that he was disposed to roll back some of the travel restrictions that the Bush administration had imposed on Cuban family to increase remittances that flow from families in the United States to Cuba. And the hope is that once that step is taken, then perhaps the travel to Cuba by U.S. citizens, non-Cuban U.S. citizens, will expand, and that, the restrictions on American travel to Cuba will be lifted.
And what would that mean for Cuba? Would that be significant for the Cuban economy?
I think if, the travel ban, if the Americans were allowed to travel to Cuba freely, the embargo very quickly becomes irrelevant. I think the relationship, the inflow of, a foreign exchange from American tourists would be substantial. It would be the thin edge of the wedge, to use a metaphor, that allows expansion of relations, both interpersonal and intergovernment.
Let us, well, I was going to say, let's talk with someone else. We had someone, they changed their mind, apparently. If they would like to call back, we can get them on. Of course, other people are certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And maybe here I'm buying into, you know, the some of the images that we have been given here of Cuba in the United States. But I do find myself wondering whether the government of Cuba might be actually a little bit apprehensive about that kind of opening of Cuba to American tourists and to American dollars and to greater possibilities, say, for American businesses to invest in Cuba. And that I'm wondering from their side whether they would be concerned about whether they could actually have some kind of control over that process, or whether fairly quickly that might become so big and so overwhelming it would kind of get away from them.
The people in power in Cuba today, the people who are in the government, people who are in Ministry of Foreign Relations, this is a question and conversations I've had with several folks in the Ministry of Foreign Relations and people who, in Cuba. Are the Cubans prepared to deal with spring break from the United States?
Yeah.
And are the Cubans prepared to deal with, what would be just a mass American tourism to the country? And the answer that I've received is twofold. One, that the Cubans will always control who enters their country. Simply that because the Americans lift the travel ban against U.S. citizens doesn't mean that the Cuba is in turn obliged to let all U.S. citizens in. So they control who enters Cuba. And two, the recognition that the problem, the potential problem posed by a massive U.S. presence in the form of tourism, that problem has to be confronted by Cuban society, Cuban officials, on how one then manages to engage and deal with this influence at the same time preserve the achievements and the gains of the Cuban Revolution. And so that's a problem that people in Cuba, people in power and people in the officialdom are very much aware of.
Yeah. Well, we do have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Indiana on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I realize this is really speculative. It's because it's a counterfactual question. If Castro hadn't done what he did and didn't go where he did, would we have had to invent somebody like that to carry on basically United States policy that was accruing at that time? And I'm thinking of the fruit company people and the banana people and all those kind of dudes who seem to want to encroach on small countries to make a lot of profits. I just wonder if you could speak to that, even if it's a sensible academic question to be asked.
My own sense is that what Cuba presented to the United States in 1959 and 1960 and 61 was a problem that was not unfamiliar with past situations. The overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala in 1954, where there's this kind of ragamuffin Guatemalan army organized by the Central Intelligence Agency that then is turned loose to overthrow the Guatemalan government, is actually the inspiration and the plan around which the Bay of Pigs was organized. In other words, once it became clear that it was in the U.S. interest to remove the Castro government, then certain kind of past practices were mobilized. The Bay of Pigs was one, covert operations were another, the multiple attempts of assassination of Fidel Castro during the early 60s. Everything that today we would call state-sponsored terrorism was practiced against Cuba between 1960-61 and the mid-60s. The Kennedy brothers particularly had a, as one recent book has called it, a vendetta against Castro, determined to remove him. So in a sense, Castro becomes almost a larger-than-life figure that is an easy object. This is the guy that Americans love to hate. He is the object of caricature, derision, attack. And if one were to compare American attitudes toward Castro and third world attitude toward Castro, they're just opposite ends, opposite polar ends. So I think that the need to invent Castro, you're right, is counter and counterfactual. And he is one of these guys who just so totally dominates the second half of the 20th century in Latin America that he is this kind of American nightmare that after 50 years, the Soviet Union is gone and Castro, albeit in feeble health, is still there and this government is still functioning, something like the commercials one sees for the Energizer Rabbit that is still going. Mm-hmm.
Next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I notice you don't talk about the Monroe Doctrine, which probably is the real reason why the Americans wanted, or their excuse to take over the Central and South America and the Caribbean. But I'm not quite sure if I understand that you seem to insinuate that the Castro government is good. I mean, weren't his soldiers proxies for the Soviet Union in the 70s and the 60s in Africa, Central America, South America, killing people. And I'm not sure if the Cuban people are that better off with their form of government. I mean, I've read a lot of there's a poet who died who was gay, who lived in New York, who was in jail for like 12 years there. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But his book about Cuba, Castro's Cuba, isn't exactly anything like you insinuate. But I agree, the American hegemony over the world or the attempt to is pretty audacious, and it's not exactly fair to a lot of people. But I think the opposite sometimes is, I mean, the Soviet Union wasn't exactly, a paradise for the, if you've read the archives in Russia. But I just want to say that, but thank you.
Yeah, I am, I think the record is still yet closed on making assessments of the Cuban relationship to the Soviet Union. The Cubans had followed an independent foreign policy in many cases, and in other cases they did indeed participate with and collaborate with the Soviets in their foreign policy. The Cuban presence, for example, in Angola was a Cuban foreign policy. It was not a Soviet foreign policy. The Cuban support of guerrilla movements in Latin America from Central America through South America in the 1960s, 61, 63, through the mid-60s was a Cuban foreign policy, not a Soviet foreign policy. In fact, it was the worst period of Cuba-Soviet relations because precisely the Cubans were following the kind of imperative, the duty of the revolutionaries to make the revolution, where the Soviet Union was talking about peaceful coexistence. The Cubans challenged the hegemony of Latin American communist parties by kind of, you know, quote-unquote, out-radicalizing them. And whereas the communist parties of Latin America were seeking electoral legitimacy, running candidates, running for political office, the Cubans were challenging them to, you know, stop the nonsense and go ahead and make a revolution. And so it's a fairly well-established fact that more Catholic priests died as guerrillas than members of the Communist Party. The Communist Party didn't support Che Guevara in Bolivia. So that it's a relationship between the Soviet Union and Cuba is very complicated. Cuba has its own foreign policy, but Cuba also, you know, recognized its obligation to the Soviets. And I think the best analogy, if you want to understand the relationship between Cuba and the Soviet Union, is to take a look at Israel and the United States. Israel is a client state of the United States. It derives massive support, both in material and economic assistance, from the United States. But no one disputes that Israel has an independent foreign policy. And when it's convenient for the Israelis to collaborate with and cooperate with the Americans, they do so. And when it isn't, they don't.
Well, let me – I didn't – I guess I would have to say I'm not sure that I heard you, as maybe the caller did, necessarily defending the Cuban government. But let me just ask it right out. Do you think that the lives of the average people in Cuba, were they better after the revolution than they were before?
I would think you'd have to look at stages. The Cuban Revolution aspired to do something that had rarely been tried before. It came to power bearing a powerful egalitarian message. It came to power, if I had to summarize and encapsulate what the Cuban Revolution was all about, is about social justice and self-determination. These are the two elements that probably are most opposed by the United States, certainly in the Third World, especially where U.S. interests are involved. And so the degree to which one can take an assessment of the success of the Cuban Revolution must at all times factor in a policy that has so totally isolated Cuba, that has totally denied Cuba access to even reasonable means of engaging the world. Most recently, again, through Torricelli and Helms-Burton. So that how one assesses that, there's no question, let me back up, there's no question that the Cuban people are not better off during the 1990s than they were in the 1960s. The collapse of the Soviet Union had debilitating and withering effect on Cuba. And so what Cuba's now left with is trying to preserve a measure of its own dignity and self-esteem in the aftermath of now a third hurricane in this year that just laid waste to the agricultural regions of Cuba. Are Cubans better off today? In a material sense, of course not. Are these a people that have a sense of who they are and what they've achieved? Absolutely.
You were talking earlier about it, you're thinking that probably what's going to happen is, or what may be likely to happen, or some people would like to see happen, is a loosening of travel restrictions so that initially Cuban Americans, you know, people who still have family in Cuba, it would be easier for them to go, and then an opening up to any Americans if they want to go. And you could expect that again, the Cubans would see the possibility of developing tourism as a great industry. There were a lot of people who would like to go. And then from there, you know, who knows where it would go. I'm certain that there are American businesses that would love to set up shop in Cuba. And I wonder, again, from your perception and what you hear from people who are living in Cuba, whether, you know, how they balance the feeling that in a lot of ways that could all be good. And that also, though, once that door is opened, then in many ways Cuba will be changed forever. It will be a completely – in a lot of ways, it's going to be a completely different place.
So many people who wish to travel to Cuba today often use the same set of images, that they want to go to Cuba, they want to visit Cuba before McDonald's and Pizza Hut
get to. Yeah.
One of the ironies of Cuba today is that the things that Americans want to travel to Cuba for – are in a way the bane of Cuban existence. Americans have this wonderful, quaint desire to go to Cuba because they want to see old American cars on the streets of Havana. Okay, and they just think that is so cool. And yet you meet Cubans who have old American cars, and they're baffled. They look at you as if you just landed from another planet. And the response is, do you think I'm keeping this car because this is my choice? And the other one is that it is probably four out of every five Cubans that I've spoken to would love to have a McDonald's in Cuba. They are not immune to this culture. So the degree to which Cuba has changed, how fast it's changed, the depth and breadth of that change, these are all imponderables, and we just don't have any idea right now.
Well, that makes me wonder whether, in fact, the Cuba, for people who think they would like to go, the Cuba that they're expecting to find, the idea of it that they have, does that even exist now?
No, it doesn't. And we have North Carolina has a study abroad program with the University of Havana in the spring semester. And we just had an orientation meeting with the students who are leaving for Havana in January. And one of the things that we emphasize is do not romanticize Cuba. There's this wonderful thing that people think of Cuba and the Buena Vista Social Club and how lovely it is and the music and the mojitos and an occasional Havana cigar and the revolution and Fidel Castro. And the fact of the matter is life is very, very difficult in Cuba.
And just one last thing I guess I'm interested in now, what you might say about Cuban Americans and their influence on American policy toward Cuba and how that may be changing.
I'm of the opinion that the Cuban-American influence American foreign policy is a myth. It doesn't exist. I think, again, to use a metaphor, this is not the tail that wagged the dog. This is the tail wagged by the dog. The Cuban-American bloc is a creation of American policy. And I think I read last week that the Cuban-American vote split by about 35% for Obama, which is the highest that there's been a Democratic vote for. Now, my sense is that that's because Obama has spoken to the specific needs of a generation of Cubans who really do want to go back and visit family. But the conventional wisdom is, which I'd like to see this documented, that there is the generational divide is deepening in Miami-Dade County.
In terms of attitudes of younger people and
exactly.
older people.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
And in what sort, I mean, how would you characterize the difference?
Well, there's the perception that 50 years of embargo has not worked and that you see surveys of younger people saying, you know, something commonsensical as, well, why don't we try something new? Why don't we try something different?
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Louis Brez, is professor of history at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk, The Cultural Politics of Identity and the Cuban Revolution. This is an event in the MillerCom series this afternoon, 4 o'clock, in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. The programs are always open to the public and free. Anybody who would like to attend is welcome. You also might want to look at his recent book, Cuba in the American Imagination, and it is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting Haydn's Mass in Time of War at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, November 22nd at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Featured will be soprano Ollie Watts-Davis, mezzo-soprano Elizabeth Buckley, and the Bach Chorus. Ticket information is at 355-9077 or at prairieensemble.org. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about AIDS and the United States. Our guest will be Philip Alcabes. He is professor of urban public health and coordinator of the Master of Public Health Program in Community Health Education at Hunter College, City University of New York. He'll be joining us by phone in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right to the prices, where in Kansas City, December wheat is trading at $5.97.5, now $5.97, up 21.5. March, $6.12, up 21.75. December wheat at the Board of Trade at $5.48.5, up 15.5. July, $5.97, up 14.5. December corn at $3.70.5 is up 1. March, $3.86.25, now $3.87, up 3/4. July, $4.09, unchanged. December of 2009, $4.31.75, down 1.25. November beans, $8.77, down 8.25. January, $8.85, down 10. July, $9.12, down 11. November of 2009, $9.08.5, down 10.25. December soybean oil, 32.41 down 17. January, 32.76 down 21. December live cattle, 91.15 up 62.5. November feeders, 97.30 up 45. December lean hogs, 56.50 up 105. And February bellies, 85.95 up 100. Outside markets, December crude oil, 57.25. It has turned to the positive. It's up $1.09. Silver.